Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Silhouettes, and it's about, well, it's about a one-woman show that chronicles 100 years of fashion history. Is that fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment.
And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about silhouettes, who is the one woman, I guess, of silhouettes. Miss Bonnie Rosinski, thank you so much for doing this, for being on here. I must confess to listeners or whatever, you were such a big part of my adult formative years. Really, and shaping who I am, that this is kind of a nice moment.
Very interesting, Matt, considering that you say that I shaped who you are, when basically what I did was dress you in clothes that you never would have worn in real life, since you were wearing costumes for the productions that we did.
So I guess we should explain that. We are in, we're not home, we're not in Pittsburgh, we are in lovely and beautiful Loretto, Pennsylvania, on a day that'll be spring for the next 12 hours, and then it'll be winter again. And you were part of the creative team behind the St. Francis Theater for how many years?
46 years.
46 years. And so I was a small, four of those 46 years I was around. And yeah. But yes, and it was me wearing clothes that I wouldn't normally, cocktail dresses. I think some of the other scrubs, medical scrubs.
Right. Things from Hunchback of Notre Dame time.
That's right. That's right. There was, I think, some
long
tights.
Long robes and things. I did, honestly, Matt, I did not go back to detail which shows you had been at.
I can barely remember myself.
If I drag up the chronology, which is in the other room, I could probably.
So Tempest to Crucible.
Tempest to Crucible. So, all right. So Tempest was set in postmodern, so that took place in all different kinds of different time periods regarding the clothing. We deal with Crucible was our own take on 1690s American things. So, of course, that show was one where we used costumes that had been created in past years and repurposed them for that particular production. So it didn't necessarily mean dealing with clothing from skin out, but taking pieces that we already had and creating the accessories, the hats and the collars and the ruffs and the sleeves and things that went on to the tunics that had already existed. So that was always a challenge for me, was to how to take something we already had and then repurpose it a bit so that it kept the budget down. And
I think that was certainly a great kind of utilitarian kind of talent was that you and Ken always had, was making virtue out of necessity.
True. And that was the challenge, and I think in the long run, that was the thing that taught us the most.
Yeah.
So that in terms of continually learning, it was learning what we had to learn for each production, and then how can you apply that and make it come to life on things that we already had, or if we were to make it new, what available materials we had to work with. So that was... So we were all forming ourselves as we were going along.
Yes, in a sense. Yes, it was, and so I guess this too, like virtue out of necessity. I guess to explain what Silhouettes is, your one woman show, and the base is a simple black garment.
Right. So if I were to read, I will read what I usually send out to women's clubs when they ask. And I say, Silhouettes is a one-woman fashion show featuring Bonnie in her black dress, and you have to see it to believe it. The 45-minute lecture demonstration presents the shapes of modern clothing from 1890 to 1990 and highlights the social, political, and economic influences which explain the fashion trends for the last 100 years. So really, with Silhouettes, the idea that a silhouette is a shows just the shape of an object, that if we look at the clothing from 1890 to 1990, we can distill a distinctive silhouette, a distinctive shape for each decade as we go. And by using the black dress, I can turn myself into a living silhouette, which I never can take off and I never leave the stage, but I'm able to transform that from one silhouette to the other. And the show originated because a woman from the community who had been in a production of Sound of Music in a summer theater production that Ken directed asked me if I would put together some sort of fashion show for her mother-daughter banquet at a local Methodist church. And of course I told Dixie I would, and then I had to do it. So...
But which was, I mean, isn't that the case of, I think, everything that we got into, or everything, at least my experience doing theater was?
So somewhere along the line, I had seen still photographs of a skit that had been done on the Ed Sullivan show. I did not see it in person. I just happened to see these photographs where there was a figure that did... I want to say seven, well, because it was the 1950s is when it ended the silhouettes, but there were these series of photographs of this one dress with added accessories that did a short fashion history. So I thought, well, if I look at this, can I do it from 1890? And then can I do it past the 50s up to the present? Because that was 1980 when this all came up. So I took myself to the sewing machine, and I made a black dress, and I spent about a week in front of the mirror moving it around and making adjustments, and then dealing with hats, because up until the time when the Catholic Church said that women did not have to wear a hat to church, women always wore a hat. And so due to the kindness of women in the community who would clean out their attics and say, oh, Bonnie, I have all these things. Maybe you can use them in a show. And they would give me this wonderful grouping of hats. And so I cataloged them and squirreled them away, but was able to go back through the boxes and locate one hat from every period of time, from 1890 up to 1990. And then I could deal with the hat. So it dealt with a one dress, one full skirt, two belts, and hats for each time period. And I put it together, and then it went on from there. And I still call it the show that has nine lives, because it's been morphed into more than one type of production. But the basic one was silhouettes, and I would go out and do this. I think when I looked at the chronology of all of the paperwork that I kept, there was between 1982 and 1984, I presented it 45 times. There was one time when I had 28 performances out of 31 days in May.
Wow.
So it got to be so popular that women would say, oh, I've seen your show three times and it's so wonderful. And that's when I realized I had to do another show. So then I invented From the Fig Leaf On, which goes from Adam and Eve up to 1860 and Scarlett O'Hara. So that technically, if someone were to see the two programs, they would have almost the whole of fashion history in one way or another. So what really was, the silhouettes especially, became a repository of all of the information that I had from when I would research the costumes for any particular time period. I would have all this information that was in my head, but it didn't have to be in the heads of the audience. All they had to see were the clothes that came out of it, the costumes that came out of it, so that really this became a repository for a lot of the research information. I never kept a bibliography over all those years that I was doing this research, so it's really tricky when people say, well, where did you get that information? I said, well, if you come down to my library, I could show you the book, but I can't tell you exactly where. So somehow, in the process of all of this, realized that for each decade that I talk about, there was a particular influence that I distilled that explained why the silhouettes were the way that they were, why the shapes were what they were. What made them change, sometimes that comes up, sometimes it's not necessarily evident, but connecting it to social, political, and economic happenings was where I found that it was really made the thread make sense, and it wasn't just that women changed clothes all the time.
Yeah, which I think for me is, because I remember seeing it, actually, I'd seen it, I think I saw it once in the 90s, and I saw it last summer of 2015, for like the second time. Thinking about how interesting it was that there were all of these collisions of the social and the economic and the geopolitical, you know, World War II is part of this show.
Right.
You know, and what does that do to how, you know, people present themselves, which I thought was fascinating. And it so reminds me of this idea that culture makes us. You know, that we, culture is a form by which we can articulate certain maybe needs or values. And how, for me, it was so interesting that silhouettes was like a nice microcosm of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what is in a dress, what is in a hemline, that there is a meaning to it. And I'm saying this as a purely sort of male anti-fashion person, you know. I took the, you know, wearing all black all the time because I'm never overdressed and never underdressed. I'm just dressed. And as a male, I can get away with that. You know, as a male college professor, I can get away with that professionally, I think, in a way that if I had a female colleague who wore the same thing, literally, I mean, I have about 30 V-necked black sweaters, one of which I'm wearing right now. I literally have about 30 of them, I think, at this point. And when it gets cold out, that's every morning. Oh, I'll wear one of these.
One of these. Well, yeah, but you know. Oh, okay. Brain fart. Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes.
Has his closet filled with 35 gray hoodies. Because that's all he wears.
Yeah.
For the same sort of idea that this is what I've done to shape my visual identity, and I've done it for very specific reasons, whatever they are. One of them was that he never has to figure out what he's going to wear in the morning, which
that's
is absolutely true. And as far as you dressing in black, well, Ken always dressed in black for kind of the same reason, that you never had to worry about what it was you were going to wear. I wear black because I don't have to worry about matching, and then because I really do love color, I can put whatever color I have with black and it will look really good. And then there's accessories that can go. So I did have a professor in college, my math professor, Dr. Murphy, Mrs. Murphy. She didn't wear the same clothes all the time, but in the 3 years I took math class, I never ever saw the same set of earrings and necklaces ever again.
Wow.
Every day she had, every time we had class, she had a different set of matching accessories that she wore. And that to me was kind of fascinating. And truly with Ken, he always had the ties.
Yes.
We had like suitcase full of ties. Nice. That he wore, and they were specifically themed for particular classes. If there were particular topics that he was addressing, he would wear that. There was something for a holiday, so that always became a focal point and also a jumping off point for discussion or whatever. So that was kind of interesting. Yeah, when we talk about fashion, early on when I was doing this program and I had to think about this, I did go to the dictionary to look up fashion, and it said clothing that's in style in any time period. And then I looked up style and it said fashionable clothing. And then I totally understood why students told me the dictionaries were no help. Because my students would say, Mrs. Gay, I looked it up and I don't understand, but it didn't make sense and I can't figure it out.
That was the George W. Bush definition. Fashionable. You know, it's in fashion.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
I mean, one of those defining the word with the word
exactly.
kind
so
of things.
That got to be interesting. I don't remember whether I think it must have been Ken when I, somehow in a discussion that we had, we said, you know what style is, don't you? I said, well, okay. He said, well, in the theater, we call style is a visible expression of a state of mind. And so this made a whole lot of sense, and I think that's what began to tie in the idea of what is it that shapes the state of mind that then gets expressed in what we see visually. Mm. And so if we look at any, if we look at architecture, we look at art, we look at...
Cars.
We look at anything, yeah. Anything that...
Food.
Man makes. Correct. That we acquire and that we espouse in one way or another. It's a visible expression of a state of mind. And so that's what set me off looking to, okay, so if we're looking at 1890, what's the state of mind that deals with that? So not only did it become, it became more than just dealing with what clothing women wore, it became what is it that produced, not produce, but what is it that made them acquire this particular thing at this particular time, and came up with ideas for that. So, yeah. So your state of mind, my state of mind is that we want something that's basic, that looks good all the time, that can go from night and day, that will not cause the disturbance to take anything away from what it is that we're focusing on.
Yeah.
And, so that's our state of mind. So that becomes our style. So that it's not just saying what's fashionable, because as I'm learning through a course that I'm taking at the moment, fashionable is so tied to economics that that's not necessarily style.
Interesting. So, so I'm thinking, okay, so this divorce between economics and mindset... Or
it's not so much a definite, it's not so much a division. I think that what I've been grappling with, and one of the reasons I wanted to take this course, which is called A Global History of Fashion, is, okay, one of the reasons I wanted to take it was sort of to reassure myself, not just learning more about it, but reassuring myself that everything that I've put into these particular programs has a validity beyond me saying I'm down in my workroom and I'm down in the library learning about this stuff so I can make costumes. What is it that I've really pulled out of here, and is it as valid as I think it is?
I see.
So the question, which has not been answered in class, and I don't know whether the question will come up on its own, but if we're dealing with fashion, we are truly dealing with an economic system in any time period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then what I have learned so much at this point is that it's all relative to fabric.
Yeah.
And so looking at types of fabric, looking at when types of fabric were loomed, where they were loomed, how they got from one place to another, and what was the economic impact. And once there's an economic impact, it becomes a social thing. So fashion becomes social, but only through all of these other things that happen. And that's been really interesting for me to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, maybe is the most radical expression of that polyester.
Oh,
since, you know, I mean that you the fabric of the petrochemical age, right?
Yeah, but I have not been in a store lately, particularly because I'm not necessarily a shopper. But as soon as the the latest oil crisis and prices for oil went so low, my next question was, are we going to see a resurgence in polyester because they can get raw materials cheaply? Where, which is when polyester came up and we did this the first time, then as soon as we're dealing with the Gulf War, we're dealing with the oil crisis of the 80s,
yeah.
79, 80s, what happened there is immediately designers went to natural fabrics. That's when linen and cotton and wool and rayon even started coming back into clothing. Excuse me, big thing on rayon, which I always assumed was what they would call, it's not a chemical, it's a man-made fiber, but it is not necessarily a chemical fiber. Okay, because you can dye rayon the way you can dye cotton and linen, mm-hmm. but you cannot dye polyester without an exorbitant amount of technology that wow. deals with it. So as soon as we couldn't get the oil to produce the polyester, then the natural fibers began to creep
Come back in.
Yeah, and yeah.
Well, and I think, too, is a part of, well, a couple things. One, actually, the no polyester thing is good because you're safer in lightning. If you're struck by lightning, polyester melts.
Well, not and only then, that, but you realize that the polyester also, excuse me, spawned that whole idea that you could not have a certain amount of chemical fibers, yeah, chemical content in children's
clothing,
sleepwear, because if they were in a fire, it would just melt onto their body and cause greater burns than actually if they had been wearing cotton fabric and it had you could extinguish it. Once you try to put out a fire that's burning polyester, it just sticks to the body and it's pretty terrible.
It's like napalm.
Yeah, well,
it's the same idea behind napalm. You know,
exactly,
it's like wearing napalm,
right? I mean, speaking of napalm and everything, there was a time when I was cleaning an oven with DuPont oven cleaner, and I decided that it must have been a byproduct of napalm that we all had that spray on oven cleaner.
Which is, hey, you know, I mean, there is that thing of maybe the post-war years and the petrochemical age of this. Sort of radical, like, spirit of, we're going to make things so totally new, and it'll be, everything will be the whatever of tomorrow today.
Right.
You know, there was that great spread in the Sunday New York Times. They did actually pictures of recipes from the Betty Crocker, like, 1960 Betty Crocker cookbook or the cards or whatever. And I actually showed it to my students a couple weeks ago because the foods were so unnatural. I mean, there was like a tomato-flavored Jell-O or something. And the way that, granted, they put a filter on the camera, but this was this idea, this is the food of the space age.
No, you're right, because this Christmas when I was in Colorado with my mom and we were looking through cookbooks for something, I happened to pause at the cookie section. And what they were... And this was a Betty Crocker. No, it wasn't Betty Crocker. This was Better Homes and Gardens. And what they were showing was just a totally... You're right, they put a filter on it. But they wanted to make it look colorful. And they wanted to make it look extreme in
yeah.
terms of maybe that it was luxurious. And,
luxurious and
it was
extremely
really
new. And
bizarre.
It's the tail fin on a car.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
It's not in any way functional, but... It's new.
And going even
and
back, let's see, when was it? One of the days of QVC when they started selling KitchenAid mixers and they were starting to get them in all the different colors. And then all of a sudden, one time they had the pink one and they did that for breast cancer survivors, right? Mm. However, if we were to go all the way back into the late 50s, we would find that there was an entire kitchen of Frigidaire appliances called the Kitchen of Tomorrow Today, and all of the accessories were pink.
Wow.
And my mom had a friend whose kitchen was the Kitchen of Tomorrow Today. She had gotten all of the original pieces and put them in as a decorator thing in her kitchen.
Yeah. Wow. Which is so that I think there's also then within Silhouettes a history of social change.
Oh, too, absolutely.
And because you think about that, you know, the Kitchen of Tomorrow Today is this almost sort of modernist kind of concept. Oh, we're going to reject the past. And I think there's also an element within Silhouettes of maybe daughters rejecting the worlds of their mothers too, right?
Well, sure. And that comes, of course, it comes most dramatically in the 1920s when women could cut their hair and could shorten their skirts above the ankle and sometimes above the knee, so that definitely was a departure. But again, it was the whole idea of youth And always, we will find that if you look at the history of fashion, it's always the young people who end up pushing the envelope, and then that causes all kinds of anxiety in their parents, and eventually gets won over somehow. I mean, when women look at that, and then you begin to have a jealousy with your daughter that she has all of this ability and freedom that you have not been able to have, and maybe I can have it too. And so then you end up with mothers who end up looking like their daughters, and now today there are times when you can barely determine who is older.
Yeah, I mean, the whole normcore thing, which is so bizarre, like, let's look like 80s office workers. Like, that, of all things to choose. I mean, granted, I think that's something that maybe comes out of urban youth and poverty a little bit. You know, it's a way of people showing off from things, you know, that were donated to Goodwill. But, you know, I think, too, then, it's interesting how it becomes mothers, daughters rejecting their mothers, but also, and I notice this even in the audience reaction, and I think you talk about this, you've incorporated this into part of your narration as you're changing into these different silhouettes. There is also then a nostalgic element to the show, and in terms of the audience's appeal and the audience, I remember when people wore that, or I remember looking like that, or really wanting that type of dress.
Right, I do at some point in the, either sometimes at the beginning, sometimes at the ending, remind myself, and I did used to remind the audiences when I was, 30 years younger, reminding the audiences that there were women in the audience who had worn more of the clothing than I did. Mm. And so what happened there was, again, they look back and remember, and young people can say, oh, is that what you really wore? And all this remembering, I always call it the collective energy of memory. Mm. That does end up becoming a totally... it's a feeling. There's no way you can touch it, but it does bind everybody together. And if they don't speak of it while they're there, I do know of people who are either telling somebody or having conversations in the car on the way home about things that they've either seen or questioned in the show. So it's a
kind of cultural glue.
It is. It is. And I think that, as also in the what do you call it? I always task the audience with the homework to, at Mother's Day, to drag clothing out of their closets. And don't expect the younger generation to think it's beautiful, because they won't, because it probably isn't to their eyes. But the reason that the clothing has been saved is not because of how much it cost. It's not because of who designed it, even necessarily, for those of us who don't buy designer clothing. But it's the stories that are attached to it. Yeah. So whatever story is attached to that clothing kind of is the reason why that clothing's been squirreled away. And those are the things that are worth saving. The clothing is worth saving for a number of reasons, other than, as you say, a glue that holds it together. But the stories are the things that are really important.
And I think for me, one of the most interesting sort of artifacts or things, and I think there was sort of an audible gasp when you pulled it out, was that from the 1950s, whatever that thing is with the pom-poms, what is that thing? This is how fashion ignorant I am. What is that thing?
The thing is the little tie-on collar that was marketed to be worn with a sweater set. Now, that meant a short-sleeved, jewel neck, finely knit sweater, and together with that was a long-sleeved button down the front cardigan, and it was called a sweater set. And you wore them with you could wear them with a straight pencil skirt, or you could wear them with a full skirt with a petticoat underneath. And so women would wear those, and somebody, I don't know, I've never researched how this came about, but someone decided that because it was a jewel neckline and women usually wore collared things, then they should have something to go around the neckline. Mm-hmm. So rather than it necessarily being jewelry, they had this little collar that you could tie on. Now, the one that I always say was most popular was one that had fur balls at the end of the ties. And the one that I use in the show was actually given to me by a woman who was the grandmother of some students I taught at my high school. And she said, I think you can use this for your show. And it is. It's white rabbit fur with two white rabbit fur balls at the end of satin ties. And you just tied that on, and it was supposed
to
be
and then you brought that out. And people and just the reaction. Yes.
And everything that I talk about, I never expected that this would be the thing that everybody remembered. And then, of course, I explained to them that I realized that the reason everybody had it was because we had television. And that came from looking at books, Time Life books that I had downstairs for every decade of the 20th century. And in there, under entertainment, was a whole section on television. And there was Dinah Shore, and she always gave this kiss to America at the end of her variety show, and she had on a little tie-on collar with fur balls at the end of the ties. And that's when you realize that it's what we saw on television, which is what people then wanted, and then you went out and got it, and then you had QVC.
Yes. Yeah, which is, you think, you know, because you also have as part of it, right, you have a hat from the 1890s, right?
That hat's technically, I think it is, if it's not 1890s, it's definitely 1900, and yeah, it's totally silk and taffeta, and the feather on it is, I think, pretty much its own feather, and yeah, it's really lovely.
See, that would be the thing I think would be, it's the oldest thing here. Yeah. But yeah, it is. It's so interesting, too, because you're saying about television, that's right, and how media also is maybe part of this matrix. That you have this power to broadcast.
Yes.
And a look.
And I do have to say that regarding television, much of my costume aesthetic came because I always watched Sonny and Cher. And if I were to say who was my best teacher, I would have to say it was Bob Mackie. Because he taught, from watching his designs, taught me the value of having, no matter where it was, a finished edge with a piece of lace or a finished edge with something was valuable. Whether it read at a distance or not, if it was close up, which is what always happens with the camera on television, is that you want to have something that you see when the camera is close to the subject. And so to make sure that it would be that detailed close up is something that I always use to make sure that from a distance there was also something. It might be indefinable, but it was still there. So he was really instrumental, and watching those shows were instrumental in much of my design aesthetic in terms of detail and color and things of that sort. In talking with Kate Fairhurst, our friend, regarding clothing today and the whole red carpet thing and designing for celebrities and celebrities wearing all of this clothing, she said, well, you think it kind of started with Cher and Bob Mackie, because he would create these absolutely phenomenal things for her to wear on television. And so perhaps the idea of dressing to, not to extreme, but dressing to
extravagance?
Yeah, but his was always an understated extravagance. His was always an extravagance that was certainly purposeful, because it had to fit whatever was being done on that sketch or whatever that song was. I mean, he did it for Carol Burnett, too. So he had a whole range of being able to, but it was always totally appropriate for whatever was being done, even to the point that even now, pretty much everybody knows the whole Carol Burnett's Scarlett O'Hara take when she comes downstairs wearing the curtain rod that has the green curtains on it that come from Scarlett O'Hara making the gown that she goes to see Rhett Butler in out of the curtains. And so so his was, it was extravagant, but it was always an extravagance that was founded in something. I don't necessarily find that still having a little bit of trouble articulating my feelings regarding some of the red carpet stuff that we deal with.
Well, you know, I think, too, is that maybe is this then an issue of sort of class and history then, too? And is there a collision there?
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, this sort of 1890s woman You know, I'm thinking of the silhouette and how, you know, that silhouette sort of distorts the body, and it's also maybe not a silhouette, a body shape, a fashion sense that really is centered around work or the ability to do work.
Right.
Whereas opposed to the fashions that you detail, you know, later were for women who didn't have servants.
Well, that's true, too. And when I talk about 18th century clothing, and I in the Fig Leaf program, and I have an 18th century corset that I had reproduced, and you have to have someone lace it up the back. My cynical observation is that if we all had clothing where we couldn't dress ourselves, we could solve the unemployment situation. But then by 1840, so you go from the 18th century, you go maybe from 1750 on, and then by the time you reach 1840, and then 1860, where Scarlett O'Hara would be, you have hooks and eyes so that you can hook it up in the front, but you have to have someone lace it up in the back still. But there gets to be a thing there. So yeah, there was a whole movement in there. So in the bustle definitely disappeared because World War I, and women had to go into the factories, and so they couldn't move in the clothing from 1890 and 1910. They had to move into a state where they could move and become more mobile, because they had to.
Yeah. Which, and so you think about some of, you know, the red carpet dress. I'm thinking of the dresses that are cut down the middle almost to the navel. You know what I mean? That is not a dress for work. That is not a dress for, that is just, it almost goes back to like some weird like Marie Antoinette stuff.
Right.
You know, which is sort of like, I am just, this is just to be seen. This is just to float through or whatever and be, and we have people for the other stuff, which is, I think, is this weird kind of new gilded age that we're in, right? That we
it could very well be in a very weird sense that way, although we have to, when you say that not made for work, but I have a feeling that if we were to look at a definition of work for those women, and I have to say women, okay, mm-hmm. For those women, that is their work.
Yeah.
To be at the red carpet and to do this. But I still have some ambiguous feelings about it, because the men, with the exception of what Kevin Hart and what he wore to the Oscars, which was all jeweled on the edge and everything, everybody else was pretty much darn the same. Yeah. And Chris Rock's tuxedo had lovely lapels, and that was a little bit of a different a departure. So, but the distinctions in tailoring for men are definitely not as obvious as what we're dealing with women, and so it's
And it is weird. Is it like there's also maybe a great sort of stagnation in fashion that does, because I think, you know, some looks from the 90s are still weirdly contemporary, or at least for male fashion. I know is this big kind of, I know Ken used to always say, you know, remember, you know, someday we'll look back at, you know, when everybody wore t-shirts everywhere all the time. And I think he said that 20 years ago, and we're still there. You know what I mean?
I never heard him say that. That's great.
He said that one time. It was
we'll
in the office. We were working
wore
on a set
all the time.
Yeah, he's like, someday we'll look back in this era where everybody wore jeans and blue t-shirts and blue jeans everywhere all the time, and we'll look back on that and laugh. And I will say, I use this sometimes in the classroom. I will say the blue jean is no longer as ubiquitous as it used to be. But yeah, the t-shirt still, yes. It's unquestionable. It's universal. You wear a t-shirt. You go out, you wear a t-shirt. You go to class, you wear a t-shirt. You know, work, no.
Yeah, and I haven't quite figured that out. I really haven't. I mean, the only time I wear t-shirts is in the summer when I teach Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I have a t-shirt for every Shakespeare play. So that becomes a teaching tool. But that's pretty much the only time I wear t-shirts.
A t-shirt.
Yeah, I don't know what would make it change in there. A year ago, I went to a discussion on a book called The Lost Art of Dressing by a woman from Notre Dame, and she, in the course of her discussion, she definitely has contempt for clothing after 1960. But before that, she details the rise of the home economics movement that grew up through the Department of Agriculture and explains home ec classes in the high schools. And that for me was another mind-opening thing in terms of fashion because of all of the ways that women were expected to dress and for to dress for occasions. And of course, that fed into an economic thing, let's face it.
Yeah.
So looking at the times from, I'd say, looking at things from the 1980s to the present is kind of, it's still kind of nebulous because we haven't necessarily coalesced how we feel about what happened 30 years ago and and how we are today.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, I mean, those post-war years was there also, well, actually, even going back, you think of these two eras. So Robert Hughes in Shock of the New, I think he says, you know, think about if you were alive from 1880 to 1920, you probably would have seen more changes, social, political, and technological, especially changes, than probably anybody, than that happened in those 40 years, than happened, you know, since the birth of Christ, basically, he says. You know, that you suddenly have airplanes, automobiles, wireless communication, all of these things, which then, you know, also have has this kind of sense of rapid, the rapid and the new and the whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you think, at least for Americans, this sort of post-war optimism, you know, sort of thing. I mean, there is that book called The Great Stagnation that argues, it's a nice little thin economic text, if you like reading little thin economic texts.
Oh, I think I could manage that,
Yes, that basically says is the reason why our economy is now the way that it is, well, we picked all the low-hanging fruit for economic expansion. You know, like we invented automobiles, and we can make automobiles perhaps incrementally better, but in terms of a whole fundamental new economy and a whole new engine for economic growth, around that you're not going to get that anymore. And same thing with airplanes and even computers. He said maybe the personal computer was like the last one. And so now that we picked all the low-hanging fruit, in order for there to be economic growth and expansion again, some sort of radical new technology has to come about. And since it really hasn't, you know, my smartphone sort of, and there's a whole economy built around those devices. But beyond that, like, you know, modern life is kind of right now set up. And so he says is that's maybe why, you know, we don't have the growth that we're sort of expect. You know, we expect it to be the 50s and 60s forever. And maybe we'll never get back to that. But maybe that's part of it is we're kind of, not that we're stuck, but maybe we are. Maybe as much as we live in a world that's very fast and our sense of time is accelerated, maybe actually our sense of social change might actually be slowing down in a weird way.
Oh, yeah. I can see that. Yeah. Part of what we were dealing with in this class, and this is Dr. Bowe's contention, and his feeling, I think, take on this is the question of when did the Industrial Revolution really start?
Mm.
And according to what we've been dealing with in class, that the most historians deal with it starting in the 19th century.
Mm.
But this is where the whole idea of the concept of fabric and textiles has come in, because if it hadn't been for the importation of cotton fabrics from Asia, we wouldn't have had the technological jump start to find ways of creating those fabrics at home.
I see.
To deal with offsetting importation and that kind of economic system. And then, of course, that brings in the whole issue of, okay, so in England they decided that, yes, they could manufacture cotton, so what does this do with us for Americans? We're the ones where they get the cotton. They import the cotton from the South, and then we get into that whole game of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden I go, okay, so I'm dealing with fabric, and I love fabric, and I work with fabric, but it's one of those things kind of like, food, do you really know where your fabric comes from?
Yeah. Fair trade cotton, is that a thing? You know, there's fair trade coffee, but
no, there is fair trade cotton.
No.
How did I find that out, that there was fair trade cotton? It's somewhere in this semester I was dealing with it. Yeah, I think there was fair trade cotton, or at least something. No. It was a student a student who was bending my ear about wanting to be a fashion designer, and one of his friends works out of Toronto, and in the course of looking at the fiber content of his friend's clothing, there was a particular sort of cotton that, mm-hmm. yeah, if it's not fair trade, it's something that's definitely
ethical as opposed to,
yes,
you know.
And of course that carries its own cachet. Mm-hmm. So what are you paying for? Are you paying for a superior product, or are you paying for the cachet that comes with it being fair trade or whatever? So it's a tricky thing.
Yeah, it is. And it also, you know, I think the other big thing, or the last big thing I want to hit on this idea of silhouettes too, is how the clothes make people. And I think I'm thinking back to, you know, what you said in the beginning about dressing me in clothes that I wouldn't normally wear. And how, you know, when I was doing acting, you know, I remember there was this weird string of about three shows in a row where I even had special underwear.
Let me go find that chronology.
Uh-oh, we're gonna pause. Uh-oh. Okay, so we're unpaused, the cat is fed.
Right.
We have the comprehensive list of 46 years of shows.
Yep, yep.
And the point I was making was about how clothes make the people is that I went through a period of at least two shows in a row where I had special costume underwear.
Right.
And then after that, I think I pretty much made sure that I did because of something that, or that I just had something either of my own that I put aside or something that, because, you know, Ken would always say his most common sense acting advice in terms of, I think, the mental discipline of being on stage the whole time. He would always say, if you're thinking a Matt thought, you know, in reference to me, at any moment, then you're no longer acting.
Mm-hmm.
You're back to being yourself, not the character. And I found that granted, the first show was Seven Nuns in Las Vegas, so I was a show girl actually named Peaches. It was my character's name.
Oh, my God.
Which was weird. Like, I had to figure out... I remember having to figure out how to put on pantyhose, and I think I went through, like, three pairs of stockings figuring that out, because it just didn't... Like, I didn't have that skill set.
Right.
But I think from there, and then Dracula... being Renfield and being the sort of insane asylum pajamas or something that I was in.
Right.
I found that whole kind of getting rid of everything that was mine and being completely wrapped in the clothes of this other person really helped me stay in character. And it makes me think about then going back to maybe this larger issue of fashion and people and how culture maybe gives people the means to articulate themselves or their lives, about how clothes really do maybe make the person or maybe make things possible, and how that's sort of embedded in silhouettes or in just even in costuming or daily dress.
I think that was true up until the turn of the millennium, because as I said to you before we started this talk, I'm still kind of questioning where we are in terms of clothing, because clothing has not really moved beyond the t-shirt and jeans and the, what do you call it, androgynous wear that t-shirts and jeans present. Okay, yeah. So if we look at that as androgynous, okay, then maybe that begins to fit in with transgender.
Yeah.
And with...
gender equality too, correct. You know, that there's not, maybe the set roles are, the Venn diagram of masculine and feminine roles is growing, you know.
So I had a really interesting experience, maybe a mini epiphany this weekend, when I went down to DC to see a production of Twelfth Night by a group called Filter, which is a British group who travel under the aegis of the Royal Shakespeare Company. I think, I'm not sure how this works. They are not the Royal Shakespeare Company, but they use that name. So it leads me to think that they have a grant from the Royal Shakespeare Company to do new and innovative approaches to Shakespeare. And this one was the setting was a rock band that mm-hmm. does Twelfth Night as their act, including music and use of innovative ways to use electronic sound and sound equipment, and it was really quite fine. But okay, so in Twelfth Night we have a well, in Shakespeare's day it would have been a boy playing a girl playing a boy.
Yes.
Okay. So in this production, it was a girl playing a boy. It was a female playing viola. So it was a female playing a boy. And the woman who played Olivia was female. And all of them were wearing pants. And so I'm watching this and thinking, that's interesting, because none of us have any qualms about knowing, or no one has any question about knowing who these characters are, that we did not necessarily need clothing signifiers for gender. So that Olivia, you know, was perfectly acceptable for her to be this highborn lady who's wearing black pants and a black shirt and whatnot. And again, the young lady playing Viola, when she disguises herself as a boy, takes off her shoes, takes off her socks, and stuffs her socks into her crotch. And then takes a jacket from a person in the audience, whether it was a plant or not, I don't know, but took a puffy jacket from the audience and put it on so that it obscured her bust line, which was quite ample if you saw her in her T-shirt.
Nice.
So, yeah, that was a very interesting thing for me to come to those conclusions. So maybe the T-shirt and jeans thing and women in pants has something more to have said. Okay, so if we adopted pants because we feel that we're equal with men, and if men wear pants, so can I, and whatnot. But now maybe it's branching out into something more, where it's not just male-female, but it's becoming genderless, and therefore maybe more accepting.
Yeah.
So, that was interesting.
Yeah, so maybe that's, I don't know if they call that maybe the end of the Silhouettes story, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, where we go as a culture in the future.
But it is interesting when you say it may be the end of the Silhouette story. I don't know. And I this did happen when I did the program and you saw it. Now, I don't remember whether I actually commentary is oftentimes fluid, and sometimes I forget to add something, and sometimes I feel it's not necessary. But early last August, I happened to see the rerun of an Ellen DeGeneres show when, what's her name? Diane Keaton was on. And she was wearing what I end up wearing in the 1980s Silhouette. And if you're watching television very, very closely lately, you'll see that the shoulder pads are coming back, which for women of a certain age will help define the figure.
Yeah.
And, of course, then I look at it and I go, okay, so in Silhouettes you say that every time there's a world conflict there's going to be shoulder pads, and then I see these shoulder pads coming back and I'm going, okay, what are we looking for here? What are we squaring our shoulders to take on at this point? But it's been very subtle, but it's definitely there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think the shoulder pads, it was this, like, power and authority and notion, right, in the 80s of we can do it too.
Yes, but it also corresponded with that whole hanging things from the shoulder, which in some cases is a much more economical way to cut fabric. To cut, if you have a rectangular shape, then it suits the shape of the fabric, whereas if you're dealing with, like, the 1930s bias cut, if you're cutting it out of the diagonal of the cloth, there's a great deal of waste. And so there's an economics to that as well. But it also comes from saying, let's arm ourselves. It's a military sort of thing, too. Let's square our shoulders for this.
I mean, our contemporary culture of fear and you know, yeah. this idea that, oh, there's anything could happen anywhere, you know, at any time, nobody's ever safe or whatever kind of notion that I think is kind of, in a weird, bad pun intended, clothes American public life.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if what you're saying, and I hadn't thought of this until now, what you're saying about T-shirt business is a way of shrinking into anonymity, in a sense, that may have been a reaction to the fear, and maybe we're coming out of that and saying, no, we can solve this.
Yeah, or we can. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things. You know, hey, we're recording this in an election year on Super Tuesday, no
less. Oh my gosh, that's right.
That's right. Is this, you know, in spite of all of the ridiculousness and the overwrought nature of this election cycle, I think especially, there is still this fundamental question of, well, actually, what kind of country or what kind of world do we want to live in? Yeah, and so I think, of course, the, I don't want to call it the wild card of this election, but the new factor, since we were talking about sort of men's fashion has become just a uniform, but not a uniform, but yeah, it's
yeah,
become
it's
so stagnant, you know, suit for when it's formal, you know, the
cargo
occasional,
pants when it's not.
Yes, cargo pants when it's not. Yeah. Those are the two options. You know, I wonder, too, when you get to, you know, Hillary, you know, because now it's this interesting, you know, what is she wearing, you know, kind of thing. And this weird collision of politics and equality, and then suddenly, you know, we have the first, I mean, I was a little too young for Geraldine Ferraro, but you think the first, and certainly wasn't born yet for Shirley Chisholm, female national candidate. I don't know how that is played. Are we in some sort of weird uncharted territory?
We are, in a sense, but it's probably good that we're in that uncharted territory now, because if you think back to Geraldine Ferraro, we were still in an age when women had to dress as women, and there was a certain expectations for what a professional woman would look like. And what she would wear. And even for Shirley Chisholm, she had to conform to something that was not necessarily ethnic. She had to counter her ethnicity there.
Yeah.
So when we're dealing with Hillary, and I we don't see a lot of her, but I know she has to walk a really fine line as to how showy whatever it is she wears, and what it's been interesting for me to see what kind of uniform, so to speak, she's adopted that makes her look credible, that makes it look easy for her to move, that makes it look finished. And I think she does look finished. She has changed her hairstyle in the past month or so, that it's become a little bit more, I don't want to say fashionable, but it's been a little bit more tailored or whatnot in a nice way. Softened her a little bit, and just to watch her navigate this, because let's face it, if she's president, there's going to be, she'll establish her own style, and here we go again. We talk about style being a visible expression of a state of mind, and so she will establish that. Now, if Donald Trump wins and we have Ivanka in the White House as first lady, then we can speculate on what that's going to be like.
Yes.
And there's a world of difference between the two sorts of things. So, I you know, it really provocative stuff here, and just interesting stuff to watch. It really is. It really is.
Yeah. And so I guess on that note... If we've come to the end of history, the end of silhouettes, or no, the future is yet unwritten. So
well, the future is yet unwritten. Although I do have some feeling that the internet, when we talk about things that produce change in all this, so we're talking about economic, political, and social change. The biggest change, of course, has been the internet and the availability of everything at any time, including the fact that at the last fashion week, this particular spring fashion week, there were certain designers where you could indeed purchase what was on the runway immediately on your computer. so that there isn't this lag time between, oh, this is what we're showing, and then you'll be able to get it six months from now. And what was it? In the 80s, there was the whole thing of taking whatever there is, we can make it and put it in the store so that you can prêt-à-porter, you can buy it in the store and take it, and you don't have to come to the couture salon. Now it's internet porté, and you just buy it on the internet and can take it away. So there's a whole upheaval in terms of the youngins in the fashion industry upending kind of what used to be the mode of operation, and so that remains to be seen. But again, when you have everything available all the time and anything you want, then that comes down to either making choices and setting a style for yourself because of the choices you've made, or it becomes a default thing where you don't want to and can't necessarily choose what you want to make your own. So that's still for me to think about.
Yes.
So I end at the 1990s because that's cut and dried at this point.
Yes. So I think now we've talked through that. It's time for the bottom five. The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic.
Oh, no.
That are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
All right.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Question one. This is, don't worry, everybody gets this first question.
Okay.
I've actually made some new bottom five questions. Uh-oh. You're going to get a question no one has gotten before.
Uh-oh.
So.
Okay.
But question one. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, like a single cell virus or something, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
If I were to come back as
an come back as a single cell, like virus, illness, whatever, bug, like not bug, but like flu bug. You know, what would be your desired disease or illness?
Disease meaning something negative?
Well, it's all the gut bacteria that people need to live, right? I mean, that's positive. Some people have chosen that.
Whoa.
The common cold gets around. There's,
in other words, an infectious disease that would cause either a positive or a negative effect.
Yeah. There's been a whole...
Okay. All right. So this wouldn't necessarily be a disease, but if there was a way to deal with gut reactions to life and whatnot, I would say that we should come up with some sort of a mutation that would allow whatever body shape you have to be the healthiest that it could be, so that you don't have to be shamed or fear that you are not like anybody else, but that your health would be perfect for whatever genetic body type shape constitution you have.
So that was almost like the if you've ever watched the cartoon Futurama, there's one where the main character Fry eats an egg salad sandwich, has all these parasites in it, and the parasites actually like make him stronger and faster, and they like forge better like brain synapses and whatever. Like he physically doesn't change on the outside, but in the inside
he's all
they give
changed.
Him a total tune-up.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Okay.
All right. Question two, which is actually it's not a question, it's a prompt.
Oh,
it's a
no.
prompt. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. So unremarkable. So it's not like, oh, we went to Disney World.
No, it rained
one day and we made cookies.
No,
that's
okay.
What I'm looking for.
This is peculiar. But when I was before kindergarten, it had to have been before kindergarten, we lived at a place called Hughes Creek, Idaho. And actually, there's a painting downstairs on my wall that my grandmother painted from the porch of the ranger station where we lived, because my dad was a forest ranger. And because he was a forest ranger, we always had horses, and we actually had pack mules that had been left from World War II.
Wow.
And I got to ride the pack mules. Her name was Bessie. She was pretty wonderful. But Bessie knew. She was smart as a dickens. She always knew that if she really didn't want to carry the pack, all she had to do was to hold her breath, keep her belly out. They would tighten the girth on the pack, and then when it was tightened, she would let their breath out, and the pack would slide off. Okay. But she also knew that I was somewhat of a dumb kid, so when she didn't want me on her back, she would go under the clothesline, and I would get brushed off because I was too dumb to duck.
That's amazing. That is so awesome. All right. Question three is a metaphysical question. What would your idea of purgatory be like?
Idea of purgatory.
Yeah, heaven and hell are easy, I think. Purgatory, though, so we're thinking a little painful, but not too bad.
Well, you figure, what is it that in No Exit Sartre says that
hell's going, what you make of it?
Well, that and other people.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And heaven, well, we don't really know what that is, but we have some sort of concept of that. But I think part of what I think purgatory is present because we were always taught the black and the white. We were never taught that life is lived in the gray area. And so purgatory is the gray area. And for those of us who are living now, I think we're in purgatory now.
That's meta.
Ugh.
That's meta. You're almost through this. So we're on the question four. This is a question I've not asked on the podcast before. Are you ready?
So what I say is going to determine whether you keep or discard this
question. I think this is a winner. Okay. Imagine we are living in a dystopian future, and the only books allowed to survive would be those bound in human skin. Would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? Like, if this was, like, they're getting rid of all the books, and only, you know, the books bound in human skin, and so you have to kind of, like, walk to the tannery holding this thing. And, oh, by the way, we can't say Bible, Quran, or complete works of Shakespeare.
Right.
Those are taken.
Somebody's already bound them in skin anyway.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Is there a book, and if so, what would it be, that you would sacrifice your hide for?
Oh, this is a long and, what do you call that, awkward silence.
Dead air. Dead air.
Dead air.
These people are downloading this for free.
Gee whiz. Something that you would sacrifice your skin to make sure that other people... Now, bound in it, I would say it should be written on human skin would be even more valuable than just being bound in human skin.
Well, you know, I think bound in human skin is maybe, it's economical. Because it's a sheer number of people, like, you know what I mean? You know, you can do a skin pamphlets, I guess, but not, you know. But so, look, you know, you could do 1,000 pages or whatever of, you know. And so without this sacrifice, this text does not survive.
Okay. This is kind of, well, it's always going to be off the wall. But thinking about things, I would say... I might be willing to sacrifice my skin for Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Nice one.
Because there's so much to be said about relationships with human beings and with the world around you, that your past and your present influence your future, and how you deal with the present in terms of your past will indicate what your future is.
Yeah, that's great. I'm thinking about what it would be to have a Christmas Carol bound in human flesh. But it's so fitting. It's so not fitting, but it's so perfect at the same time.
Well, yeah. And there's so much. There's so much.
See, it's a first time out. You've established the gold standard for this question. Future guests are not going to live up to this.
It's curious because, you know, I read the book aloud to my students 5 times a day, and I can't tell you how many years, because I always read that one aloud, because 19th century text is so easy to skip over when you're just reading it and you go, the sentence is too long and whatever. But there is so much to be found in there, and so much that kids can learn regarding the past, to a point where when they talk about boiling the Christmas pudding in the copper kettle at the laundry, okay, so what is it like to boil food in a piece of cloth and then eat it? So I made Christmas pudding from scratch and boiled it in a muslin towel and took it to school. And although we couldn't have brandy in the hard sauce, we had hard sauce on it. Heated it all up in the microwave, of course.
Of course.
But, you know, it's just stuff like that that you just go, okay. And so that tells you about your present, whatever it is. And then how your past has influenced where you are, and will you stay where your past puts you, or will you move on to something that changes you for your future?
That's a great answer. Okay. All right, you ready for the last one? Question five. You're almost out of the woods. What mundane daily activity gives you the most joy? Is there a daily activity that you enjoy the most? Mundane thing.
Mundane.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you would call cooking, it happens to be utilitarian and not necessarily mundane. Is that true?
I would count that, yeah.
But yeah, cooking really does provide, it provides time for mental something. Mental engagement on another level, because you can either have music on, or in this case I'm listening to recorded books, but it also has involuntary physical activity that you can do, so cleaning and chopping of vegetables and sauteing and all of those what are normal activities for cooking can happen while your mind is otherwise engaged. Cleaning house is the same sort of thing, that it's a time when the mind can rest because what you're doing is technically you don't have to think about it, you just have to know the physical routine of doing it, and then the mind develops on its own so that ideas can come up, and it's kind of a magical thing. And then of course with a clean house, yeah, you do feel better, and it's really amazing that vacuuming a rug can make things feel differently. But on the other hand, with cooking, then you get to eat it.
Yes.
And not only do you get to eat it, but you can share it with people, and that becomes really special. So thank you for enjoying my macaroni and cheese today with broccoli.
Oh, it was amazing. Macaroni and cheese, I don't want to say anything, but it was
it was good.
So wonderful.
It was good.
Oh, wonderful. So, yeah, I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later meets. Oh.